Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix. I am Johnny Anonymous.
And I am Dave Rabbit. How are you doing, John?
Very well, sir. Let's tell everybody real quick what we have on this episode. We're going to start off with, of course, our international UFO sightings.
And then, of course, we have a mystery guest up on the soapbox. And John's got a new... Yeah, don't you have a new device you're trying out this time?
I am trying a new device out.
Very good. Very good.
And, well, it's the same device we tried out last time. And it worked, so... We'll see what happens. We don't know.
Yeah, right.
We had a great interview with Jesse Ventura.
Oh, man, did we ever. And then we're going to do a Mad as Hell segment that I think everybody's going to really enjoy. It has to do with small country towns.
Yep. And then we talked to, because of a number of members that got a hold of us from our Stan Dale earthquake episode, they wanted to ask us if we had heard about another person who was also a member at ATS Mix. Or, AboveTopSecret.com by the name of Charlotte Keene. And so we called her up to ask her thoughts on these earthquakes.
Yeah, and she was really a lot of fun to talk to. And we're going to do a huge interview with her next week, aren't we, John?
Absolutely. You know, we had a lot of responses from our last episode featuring Ed Grimsley, the UFO hunter guy.
Yeah, I love Ed. Yeah.
In fact, we got one member by the name of Project Fire Phil, who lives in Monterey, and he invited me to come up there to the Monterey coast to look at the crafts from his area. So we're
I saw y'all's communication back and forth.
So we might go and investigate that. And
that'll be fun for you.
You know, since we're talking about Ed, we should give him a call and see if there's anything that's been happening there in the past week and a half in his parts.
Well, okay. I think the only number I have is his mom. You want? Shall we try reaching there?
yeah. Let's give his mom a call. That might be kind of interesting.
Okay. Well, let's give her a ring and see what happens.
All right.
I'll see. I'll ask if Ed can come out and play.
Sorry. Hello.
Is Ed there?
What?
Is Ed there?
Ed.
Yes, Ed. Ma'am. Ed?
No. Who's this?
This is Dave and Johnny from the ATS Mix Show. How are you?
Oh, fine.
We thought if Ed happened to be around, we'd give him a quick yell.
No, he isn't here. He must be home.
Okay, thank you so much. We're sure sorry to bother you, ma'am.
Well, that's all right. All right.
Thanks, bye. Love. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You start.
All right.
Hello?
Ed Grimsley, Johnny Anonymous, and Dave Rabbit here. How are you, sir?
Oh, pretty good guy. What's up?
We wanted to find out if anything's happened in the past week and a half that you might be able to update us with on your sky watching.
Well, the activity that you got to see, how there was a lot of stuff. Well, two nights in a row, there's been massive amounts of stuff. Just a couple of personal people came in, and a photographer and some a space engineer.
Yeah.
And last night, I'm going to say that we counted close to, tried to keep track of it, close to 120. And in one 45-minute period, there was 35 sightings, and they were coming from all different directions.
Wow.
And three of them came at each other and did a little dodgeball thing, like where they just came in and power dove at one and then went off. It was pretty amazing. They were... Some of them look like they're kids at the wheel.
What do you have coming up? Do you have any radio events or lectures coming up here?
I'm supposed to do some stuff on the 7th or 8th and show up at the conspiracy conference. And we're releasing a movie, The Moon Rising. There's going to be some footage of it, and there's some other movies going to be there. And Bob Oliver from the radio station will be with us. I'm doing a show for England, over in England. And I'm doing one for France.
Okay. I wanted to quickly tell you, Ed, you need to have somebody check your email. Every time I've sent you an email, it says it sends it back saying that the email box is full.
Yeah, well, it's not full. I mean, I don't know what games are being played by whatever, but I'm having other people tell me the same thing.
Yeah.
And the email box has room. There's only 32 or 34 in there that I'm saving.
Yeah.
So I know who is where. It's a lot of things are happening. And
wow.
even movie footage.
Yeah.
Somebody is whacked into it and put up signs on it saying that there was a virus, not to order the movie because it would come down with the movie.
Interesting. So there could be a little bit of a conspiracy going on here.
Not a little bit. A lot. There's a lot more happened than would be believed, and what is still in the cell, we're trying to have it investigated up pretty good, and there's an investigative team working on it.
Okay. Keep us apprised of what the situation is, and send me an email so that at least I know what's going on, all right?
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Ed, for your time.
Take care, Ed.
All right.
Nice chatting with you again. Hey, by the way, your mom doesn't know who you are.
My mom, what, doesn't know who I am?
Yeah. We said, is Ed there? She says, Ed who? I don't know.
Yeah, Ed who?
Sorry. All right,
well,
brother.
That's because she has a brother named Ed and a son named Ed, so.
Oh, okay. Well, next time we call your mom, we'll be sure and differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
All right, brother. Have a good evening.
Just give me a call.
All right, man.
She lives in
yeah. All right, Edinator. Thanks a lot, brother. All right, man.
All right.
Nah. Well, there you have it, John. Now to the show.
All righty, then.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, whoa. What am I hearing?
What is this?
From above, topsecret.com.
Ah, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
This is Tamriel from GodBoxCafe.com with sightings from across Canada. At midnight on May 10th in Laval, Quebec, a witness was outside on the phone when a triangle-shaped object was clearly visible in the sky, about 30,000 feet overhead, traveling northwest. According to the report submitted to the HBCC, three white lights were at the points of the triangle, giving the observer the initial impression it was a plane. However, on witnessing the object cover a considerable distance at unbelievable speed, the observer ruled out the possibility that this was a man-made craft and has been out every night with binoculars and a camcorder since the event. 2 days later, at about the same time at night, three people were watching the ocean in Arbutus Cove, Saanich, B.C., when a bright flashing light reflecting off the water caught their attention. Once again, it was the incredible speed that had everyone mystified as the bright melon-shaped object stopped briefly around the Oak Bay area, then jolted northward and disappeared. Interestingly, in this case, the light that was cast by the object was so intense it penetrated the depths of the ocean water before it jerked away into the darkness. Lastly, in Oshawa, Ontario, on Saturday, May 24th, at approximately 6:30 p.m., a witness was barbecuing on the back deck when a sudden urge to look skyward caused the observer to freeze in position as a long white-silver missile-shaped object moved towards Lake Ontario from north to south. The entire sighting lasted a mere 15 to 20 seconds, and although the witness thought at one point to call in others from the household or fetch a camera, staying to watch seemed more appropriate, given the bizarre compulsion to look up just as the object was passing high overhead. This is Tamriel from GodBox Cafe, reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
These are the reported sightings over the United States. This is David C. In North Carolina, a fantastic display of several flashing lights, almost like fireflies dancing around in the sky, were observed. They would flash and switch position very rapidly, sometimes making right and left sharp turns. The lights were not a steady flash, but random flickering. There appeared to be 5 to 7 objects, and their movement did not have any set pattern as to where they were going. They appeared white with a slight tint of green. The activity occurred for about 35 minutes. In California, a viewer observed an object fly directly overhead at a very slow rate of speed. The observer stated, "The object resembled a hexagonal dumbbell that was flat black in color, the black area barely reflecting, but at the two ends of the craft, the hexes were reflecting gold and looked like material similar to what NASA uses on its satellites. No windows or lights, no sound, just the wind as it glided over. But this craft seemed totally the opposite of an aerodynamic vehicle, and also it seemed too small for human occupancy, unless they were seated in the hexes on the ends. It then, as it was around 40 yards past me, accelerated away in the same fashion it approached. The craft was approximately 20 feet wide, 10 feet long, and 6 feet thick. In Illinois, a very bright white star-like object traveling west to east was observed. There was no contrail in the sky and no flashing lights, and it looked like a large bright planet just traversing the sky in a straight line. The viewer noted, "We do see satellites go over quite often, but never west to east and nowhere near as bright as this one. It was north of us and at an angle in the sky that we would rarely be able to see a satellite at, and it was very bright." This is David C. reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
Well, John, I happen to notice that our mystery guest light is blinking again.
Yes, it certainly is, Senor Rabbit. You know what that means? It means we got somebody waiting to teleport over onto the ATS Mix Soapbox.
Well, we didn't burn up anybody in our last teleportation effort, so why don't you teleport our guest on over, John?
All right, buddy. Here's your goggles. Make sure you have them on securely.
Got them and all secured. Right.
Now remember, as I told you last time, things are going to get a little bit queasy as we're going to be bending time and space, so are you ready?
Sure, John. I'm ready. I was born ready. Hit the switch, Johninator.
All right there, Senor Rabbit. Engaging the teleportation in 3, 2, 1.
Oh, crap!
From the soapbox, it's, Oh, excuse me. Could you maybe introduce yourself, please?
Hi, everyone. This is Robert Morningstar, the editor of UFO Digest, and I'm calling in to say hi to the ATS group, Above Top Secret, Johnny Anonymous, Dave Rabbit and company, and just to share a little bit of flying saucer news updates with you. You understand you heard about the meeting at the United Nations on February 12th and the uproar that report caused. Well, we're bringing forth new information that the meetings have continued, and as the events of the last 3 months demonstrate, a lot of activity has occurred. Who would have expected the Vatican to come out and endorse the correctness or the right to believe in aliens and extraterrestrial life as part of God's creation? In France, a high-ranking admiral in the French Navy, along with 6 noted scientists, sent an open letter to the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, demanding a new investigation and serious evaluation of the purpose of UFOs activities around Earth. And the British Ministry of Defense released its X-Files with a plethora of information for researchers to dive into. I'd like to thank Springer and the rest of the ATS group for letting me have this moment on the soapbox, and I'll return everything to Johnny Anonymous and Dave Rabbit and say hi till next time. So long from Flying Saucer News, Robert Morningstar, editor, UFO Digest. So long.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Jesse Ventura has had many lives. He is a Navy SEAL, a star of a pro wrestling act, as an actor, and as the governor of Minnesota. As an author, he's written 2 previous bestsellers entitled I Ain't Got Time to Bleed and Do I Stand Alone? His latest book is entitled Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. It's based on the controversial gubernatorial years and his life since deciding not to seek a second term as governor in 2002. It reveals for the first time why he left politics, why he is now considering re-entering the arena with a possible independent run for the presidency in 2008. It's available through Skyhorse Publishing, and Dave and I just couldn't be happier right now to have on the ATS Mix Show Mr. Jesse Ventura. Hi, Jesse. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing today?
Man, what an honor, Jesse, to finally talk to you, because I really love talking to people that I have some identity with, and I definitely have an identity with you, not body-wise, I'd like to point out, but at least sometimes philosophy. But let's get to it, Jesse. You know, I mean, I always find it interesting. You know, when you were growing up as a kid, you were born July 15th, 1951. We were about 3 years apart. You're 56 going on 57. I'm going on 60. So we're really close as far as the era that we grew up in.
Sure.
What was it like when you grew up as a kiddo in Minneapolis?
Well, it was a terrific place to grow up in Minneapolis. You know, I lived in South Minneapolis in the urban setting, but it was a very middle-class, blue-collar area that I grew up in. My father walked to work every day. He worked for the City of Minneapolis Street Department. And my mother was a nurse, so I guess the best way to describe me, I was a latchkey kid. I was the kid who your parents were gone to work before you got up to go to school, so you had to get yourself to school,
right.
And then you got home before they got home, which was a good thing, because if you changed your clothes and got back to the schoolyard, that means you could stay there till supper time, because mom and dad weren't home yet to make you stay at home.
Right.
So I would have been considered a latchkey kid. I had an older brother, and we both ended up competitive swimmers, and there is no professional competitive swimming, so I guess it was a natural transgression to join the Navy and become frogmen, which is what we both ended up doing.
Well, I was just going to ask you, Jesse, what was it that prompted you to want to join the military in the first place?
Well, what prompted me really, and even though there was no pressure on behalf of my family, but my father was a World War II veteran, my mother was a World War II veteran, and my brother was a Vietnam veteran, so subconsciously, I kind of thought, how can I sit at the dinner table with these three veterans, not being one myself? So I think that was one of the motivating factors of why I joined the military right out of high school, is the fact that everyone in my immediate family was a veteran, and I kind of, it was the thing to do, I guess.
Well, you know, I was trying to, and here again, you and I are both Vietnam vets, and so, you know, that was the thing that obviously I have the most tremendous respect for you, not only your attitudes and just your philosophies, but also because of, you know, we have a common brotherhood, I believe. All of that, Stu,
sure.
But especially those of us that served in Vietnam. So you're an underwater demolition expert. You're qualified as a SEAL and have the ability to be called a SEAL. So from what I've been able to research, Jesse, and I mean, I dug really deep, but I couldn't really ascertain. Did you do three tours when you were a SEAL in Nam?
No, I did two tours to Southeast Asia, 1 9-month and 1 8-month. And by my second tour, they had pulled our commitment out of Vietnam. So I went to the Philippines.
Okay, well then my sub question would be, and then Johnny probably has a couple of questions, is when you're doing your thing as a Navy SEAL, obviously you're on a ship, and then depending on what the mission is, then they somehow get you on to the coast or whatever, and then you
Well, we're not always on ships. We're deployed in different manners. You may have a detachment, like one of my detachments, which was actually stressful but yet boring at the same time. At the end of the Vietnam War, when Kissinger was working towards the peace, we were threatening a Normandy-style invasion into Hanoi.
Really? What year was that?
That would have been 1971, 72, right in there.
Right.
Because they had the 3rd Marine, I think it was the 3rd Marine Division. We were out there circling in ships because they were balking at the peace table. And we were threatening a Normandy-style invasion, of which, of course, we would be the reconnaissance element for the Marine invasion. When I say it was boring and yet stressful, it was both, because it never happened, and you sat out there and you were bored to death, but it was also stressful because you knew at any moment the call could come. And for those of us that have studied Normandy in World War II at all, it probably wouldn't have been a pleasant experience.
Right.
Why don't you tell us some of your more memorable experiences that you can recall?
You know, my experiences in the military were positive ones. You know, naturally, I went in the Navy, and the Navy's never drafted. And then, of course, if you go into the UDT SEAL program, you're a volunteer, and you then become a member of what they call the Brownwater Navy, which today they get all the money in the world they want, because it's the type of war that will be fought at that level, and the SEALs are at the pinnacle of it. But in my day, we were not that, and we probably had to big borrow and steal a lot of our equipment because we didn't have the budget for it. And we were in essence kind of a group of pirates, I think would be the best way to describe us, because we weren't the regular Navy. We wore marine green uniforms, and we kind of didn't operate necessarily on the water all the time. So that made us an interesting unit to being part of the United States Navy. Plus, we had our own base.
Right.
So we weren't with the regular Navy at any time.
All right. You know, I'm going to ask you a question. I got to ask you a question. There's got to be a question that's asked, because everybody that served in Vietnam obviously had someone close to them military-wise that didn't make it back home. There was, you know, I had some friends die. I mean, did you have close buddies in any missions that you ever did that didn't make it back?
No, I did not. You know, we were fortunate. I was fortunate. I got in on the tail end of the war. You know, we were already drawing down by the time I didn't graduate from high school till 1969. As you said, I'm 3 years younger than you.
Right.
So I barely got there, you know, by the time I got through training and deployed in 71. And then by 72, 73, they had pulled the SEALs commitment out because we were going for peace with honor. But I still did some pretty interesting things even after the war ended, some controversial things, I'm sure, because there was one time that I went on a mission. We were locked and loaded in the Philippines, which, you know, nobody truly knows why. I mean, I know why, but, you know, we weren't authorized to do that, but somebody authorized it on this particular mission because we actually were out hunting in the Philippines for what they called the Hucks, which were the communist Filipinos.
Right.
Wow.
And, you know, that was done pretty secretive. And it was a two-day operation that we actually did in the Philippines, which I've always found very interesting, thinking, who okayed this? I mean, what allowed a platoon of SEALs to be locked and loaded in the Philippines?
Right. Well, you know, my co-host here, Mr. Dave Rabbit, he's had himself some very interesting tales that he has recounted to me about some of his R&R situations that he's been involved in. And I'm just curious, do you have any interesting stories you can share with us about some of the R&R you experienced?
Well, I took my actual R&R to Hong Kong, and I guess the thing that I enjoyed most about going to Hong Kong when I went there was, you know, as a diver, the Rolex Submariner is the premier watch. I mean, everyone wants the Rolex Submariner diving watch.
Right.
Well, at that time, you could buy one in Hong Kong for $198.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I still have that watch today.
Do you really?
Oh, absolutely. And I take it in once a year to have it cleaned, and it costs me more to clean that Rolex watch today than what it did when I bought it brand new. And I always tease my jeweler over that. I say, do you realize this cleaning costs more than the watch? Because that watch today sells for close to $4,000 to $5,000.
Oh, right. Yeah, easy.
You know, and we were able to purchase them at $198 then in Hong Kong, legitimate Rolex Submariners. And like I said, it costs more today to clean the watch than it did when I bought it new.
Wow. Well,
but actually, I've quit wearing the watch, which I never thought I'd do. Now I live in the Baja, and I've thrown my watch away. I don't live by time anymore.
Ah. Man, I love you, Jesse. You know,
we envy you.
I mean, well, I'm going on 57. I've already worked my whole life. I figure it's time to get off of a scheduled life at this age and live the rest of it. Now, when I live in Mexico, I eat when I'm hungry. I sleep when I'm tired. And that's how I live down there.
Well, you know, there's about several million guys that are looking towards your area and bowing down, you know, you're our holy grail. Okay, I got one last question about Vietnam, and this is one I know that's very sensitive to you, but I want you to tell me about it, and that is your profession that you think you occurred or acquired Agent Orange while you were in Vietnam.
Oh, no, I never did. That was a wrestling thing.
Oh, it was a wrestling thing.
Oh, yeah, that was a wrestling thing. I have no, although I did acquire something over there. At age 50, my toenails started turning black and falling off.
Oh, wow.
And my feet went numb. Wow. And so I went to the dermatologist, and they snipped off a piece of my toenail, and they sent it to the University of Minnesota. And when it came back, he asked me, he said, were you in the military? And I said, yes. He said, did you serve in Vietnam and Southeast Asia? I said, yeah, I was over there a total of 17 months. And as a frogman, you're going to be in and out of the water, you know, in a lot of dirty, crummy places.
Right.
And he said, well, we're seeing more and more of this. He said, you acquired a fungus over there. And he said, unfortunately, what we're seeing is it lies dormant in your body for 20 to 25 years, and we're seeing it now become undormant with the veterans at age in their 50s.
Holy mackerel.
And so I fortunately was treated for it, and I think it's all okay now, but I still have the numb feet.
Really?
Wow. No, yeah.
You can't feel anything in your feet at all?
Well, I can feel it with my feet, but my balance is not like it should be because I have a layer of numbness in there.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And they aren't directly attributing it to the fungus, but they can't directly say it isn't. They call it non-specific neuropathy, which 33% of people today have. It means you're numb and they can't tell you why.
Wow.
Basically. That's why they call it non-specific neuropathy. But no, to my knowledge, I don't have Agent Orange. That was wrestling shtick.
Okay.
Well, thank God for that, Jesse.
Exactly. If I had that, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today.
Well, yeah. Prone.
Well, speaking of wrestling shtick, let's talk a little bit about your wrestling career. What on earth would motivate you to want to get into a career of wrestling?
Well, when I got out of the service, I went to college on the GI Bill, and when you go on the GI Bill, I went for 1 year. You're not required to name a major. You're kind of feeling the water out to see what you'd like to be. And when I was at college, I grew greatly attached to theater. I liked theater. I actually did Aristophanes the Birds, the play, the Greek comedy, while I was in college.
Really?
And I really looked at the situation of, you know, wrestling is both theater and athleticism. It combined both.
Sure,
exactly.
And so it appealed to me that I could practice theater while yet being an athlete, because that's what pro wrestling is. It's theater athleticism. It's sports entertainment, like Vince McMahon calls it. So it offered me that opportunity, and it was an intriguing lifestyle, and so I went ahead and pursued it.
Well, let me ask you, you know, since you're involved in wrestling, I knew...
I'm not involved anymore. I haven't been involved since 1990.
Yeah, but I know, but I mean, because you have a background in it. I knew personally Fritz Von Erich from Dallas. The Von Erich brothers and father. And, you know, I really learned a lot about wrestling. I really gained a respect for wrestlers in general because they had... You know, they had such a bad rap for a long time before, I guess, the WWF and some of the others really gave it some legitimacy, right?
Let's remember this. Wrestling was always the blue-collar sport.
Right.
It was the only pro sport that went to little towns. You know, you didn't find the NBA or the NFL or that going to the small town. Now, baseball, you get it with the minor leagues more. But wrestling went out into the small towns. It went to your Yakima, Washingtons. It went to your Dubuque, Iowa. It went to your Sedalia, Missouri places where normal pro sports don't go. And so wrestling was really, it was an entertainment and sport to the average blue-collar America, much like early NASCAR. You know, NASCAR didn't develop its huge following and its national that it has today. NASCAR started to actually with running bootleg booze, you know,
right.
and then it got into these little racetracks, and it became the entertainment for small town Southern America was go to the car races.
Right, right.
And now look at what NASCAR's grown into, the same thing as what the WWE has grown into now. It's worldwide, it's national,
right.
It's huge money today. I was driving to Mexico, and they had the races in Dallas, and they were going on to Phoenix, and my God, you should see these semis that the NASCAR guys drive.
Yeah.
Oh, state of the art.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's big money in there when you're talking NASCAR today. That really was it. Wrestling, I was through wrestling and watched it grow to what it is today. From being more, it evolved out of the carnivals in the old days, and then it went into, you know, small town America and all the territories. And then I was fortunate enough to see it become the national entity that it is today with Vince McMahon.
Right.
Wow.
Well, besides wrestling as a career, you also had a career as an actor. And, of course, one of the most famous movies that everybody remembers you being in was the movie Predator. Tell us how you got involved with that movie.
Well, when I was wrestling, of course, and when Hulkamania hit the world in 1985, there was a lot of focus put on wrestling. And an agent in Hollywood I met, he's still my agent today, he asked me if I would be interested in pursuing an acting career, and I said sure if something right came up. And I did an episode of Hunter. I don't know if you remember that, the TV
yes.
show with Fred Dreyer.
Right.
And then the second thing I got cast for was Predator. And that allowed me to get my Screen Actors Guild card and my membership in the union, which I'm still a member of today. I get my retirement, my health benefits, and everything from the guild. And I maintain that I'm now a vested union member. And so it led me to a new career, one that when wrestling ended, I could continue to pursue, because people need to remember that time catches every athlete.
Yeah.
You know, even the great Muhammad Ali, the great Henry Aaron, any athlete that you name, you know, is going to get caught by time. Time catches you. And so you always have to look to the future of what do I do when I'm done with wrestling, or what do I do when I'm done being an athlete.
My favorite all-time sequence of that movie, in fact, I created some artwork and put up on the show threads, is you and that persona of Predator with the minigun, and you know you've got that shot tobacco, and I put a little sign underneath it that says "Don't screw with a Jessonator," you know. But, you know, it personifies your entire personality to me, Jesse. I mean, it really does.
Well, you know, when I got cast for the role, fortunately, I did chew tobacco because the role called for it. So it helped me get the role. They asked me, they said, well, can you chew tobacco? I said, I chew it all the time. I don't today, but I did up until 1990. That helped get the role, because the role of Sergeant Blaine, he was a tobacco chewer and he was spitting all the time, and who else could spit on Apollo Creed's boots and have him do nothing about it?
And I love that part, you know.
You know? And the other interesting thing too is then they found this minigun, and of course Joel Silver, the producer, he knew my background, and what's amazing is that whatever weapons that the U.S. military has, Hollywood will get them within 2 months.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
it's
sure.
amazing. I mean, even weapons that we consider semi-top secret, Hollywood will have them within months. So they have a big warehouse out there with all these weapons, and Silver walked in there, and nobody, you know, as you know, the minigun is tripod mounted either on a PBR or a Hilo gunship or whatever.
Yeah. Like Shadow and Spooky. Yeah, right.
It's electronically fired.
Right.
You know, there's no way you could legitimately fire it the way I did it, because you'd run out of ammunition in 10 seconds. You know, that's the other great thing about Hollywood that you learn. You never run out of ammo. When you're a soldier or a sailor and you're carrying your own ammo, the only ammo you got is what you can hump or carry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the great thing about Hollywood is you don't have to hump it, then you never run out.
Yeah, you just love that.
You can be in the biggest firefight on the planet, and you know you're never going to run out of ammo.
Well, you know, one more thing on the minigun that people don't know, because I was in the Air Force for 3 years. I did 3 tours of Nam, and
sure.
and because I was in the Air Force, you know, we had Shadow and Spooky, which were the you know, the prop planes that had the miniguns that were on the sides of the things. And
right.
the technology, as you well know, Jesse, I mean, they had infrared sightings and whatever, and they could hone those miniguns. And I think were the 5,000 rounds a minute, Jesse? Something
seven.
Like that.
Seven.
Yeah, well, 7,000.
It's 1,000 rounds a barrel, and there's 7 barrels.
Okay,
or six or seven. They shoot 7,000 rounds a minute, I think.
Right. So they can put 7,000 rounds into an area that is, I mean, literally 6 foot in circumference, because that's how accurate that Smokey and Shadow and some of the other aircraft terminologies they did. But those things were heavy. I mean, well, that was a mock one that you had, right, I assume?
Well, no, I carried the real thing.
Really?
No kidding? Wow.
It weighed 75 pounds.
Holy mackerel.
Golly.
Yeah, no, I'd have to – what we did, we built an M6 – because, again, it's impossible to shoot it like we did. I mean, it's
exactly.
possible, but not in a real situation. We took an M60 hand grip, and we built that onto – we built the carriage so that I could lock in with my web gear and take some of the weight on my neck.
Oh, okay.
We did have a weapon that was identical to it, made out of rubber. and that's the one I would carry in the bag, and then I would carry it with for any long shots. But for any close-up shots in the film, the real weapon had to come out. I'll never forget John McTiernan, the director, one day. We were in the jungle down in Mexico, and he looks over at me, and I've got the real weapon, right, 75 pounds of it around my neck. And he looks at me and goes, Jesse, be agile. And I remember I looked at McTiernan and I said, what? I said, be agile? I said, you're lucky, John, that I'm strong enough to carry this SOB around all afternoon. I said, how the hell can you be agile with a 75-pound albatross around your neck? You know? I said, God almighty, be agile. You know, but it worked out very well, you know, and we, what we would do, of course, there wasn't a trigger. They're electronically fired, so they would run a battery cable up my pants leg. They would splice it into the weapon and keep it out of the shot, and then when it was time for me to shoot, the guy off camera would simply drop the things down on the big batteries, and then the weapon would start shooting, and I'd just hold on.
Well, there's a lot of vibration to it, too, right?
Well, it wasn't bad. It didn't have. I was shooting a 7.62 round, the same as an M60, and it didn't kick much. It just torqued a little to the left because the barrel spin counterclockwise.
Right.
There was just a little torquing to the left, but at one point McTiernan was doing a close-up shot, and they got those like plastic camera covers that they use on lens.
Right.
And he said, Jesse, I want you to shoot this right at the upper left corner of lens. Well, it shoots such a ball of flame out of the weapon that when I was done firing it, I had melted the upper left corner of the plastic lens. And I looked at McTiernan and I said, was that close enough, John? He said, that was an excellent job.
Wow.
So the other fun part, too, when they were giving us all our equipment, they were giving us our web gear and our field gear for the film. They gave me a rubber knife, and I looked at Joel Silver. I said, what's this? He said, well, that's the knife. I said, but it's rubber. It's not a knife. I said, I want a real one. And so I kind of freaked them out right away when everything I wanted to be real on my web gear, but I felt I needed that to become the role.
Sure.
You know, a rubber knife? Who the hell's going to carry a rubber knife? You know, give me a real one so I feel the weight of it and know that it's there.
Of course. I mean, you know, and especially for an ex-military guy like you, I mean, who wants to carry around a stupid rubber knife? I mean, you know, come on.
So, you know, it was a lot of fun doing the film, though. The actors did very well. We got down a week ahead of time, and I was complimented by some of my SEAL teammates. They told me it's the best patrolling they've ever seen in a film because... You know, I had to learn also, though, that you can't bring realism totally into Hollywood because they're looking for camera shots.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, like I would constantly be bitching down there, we're too close together, for God's sake. If one grenade come in, it'll take the whole platoon out.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I had to learn that they're doing a film. They're not doing a documentary.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your new book that you just authored.
Sure.
Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. What on earth prompted you to want to write this book?
Well, what made me want to write it was, number one, nobody ever talked to me about my 4 years in office as an independent governing with Democrats and Republicans. I felt that was a story that needed to be told.
Right.
I also made these trips to Mexico, and I thought it would be outstanding to take people along on them, which we do. I also want to try to debunk this fear we have of these brown-skinned people that come over our border. And my feelings are such that, you know, the one sign that I really like to attribute myself to is one I saw during the protests of the illegal immigration. And the sign was simple. It stated the pilgrims didn't have visas. And I kind of thought about that and thought they're right. You know, when we came into this country, we slaughtered the Native Americans. We took their land. And now we're going to require paperwork to be here. You know, and so I want to debunk this. I see, and let me be bold on this, I really watch our country today, and I see a parallel of us blaming Mexicans for all of our illegal Mexican aliens, for all of our problems that we have, much the way the Germans seem to blame the Jews prior to World War II.
Sure.
You know, the Jews were what was wrong with Germany. That's what Hitler pounded home to all the people, was all of their problems centered around the Jews being the problem. what we seem today to be centering around these poor Mexican people that come over our borders illegally are the big problem for us. And if you're going to blame someone, blame the people who created our laws that allow them to abuse them.
Amen, brother.
Yeah. You know, don't blame the poor person trying to better themselves.
Right.
You know, after all, imagine if this country would have did that to us when we came here.
Well,
you know, and my view is today I live in Mexico. I've experienced the American dream. My wife and I, we've lived it to the fullest. My view is if two of those Mexicans want to come up here and take our spots and try to live the American dream, they're welcome to it. I'll live in their country in the interim because I like the weather better.
There you go.
Really?
A couple of weeks ago, we had Dr. David Ray Griffin on our show, and we were discussing the what he considered to be a lot of myths and inaccuracies with what happened on 9/11. And I know that you yourself have a lot of ideas on what happened or may have not happened on 9/11. Share some of your thoughts with us.
Well, first of all, I'll share with you expertise. Having been a member of the Navy underwater demolition team for 3 years, I know what it's like to blow things up. I have an expertise in that. I was trained by the best the Navy has.
Right.
Well, as I kept looking at the tapes of these buildings and how they fell, I may be wrong, but with my expertise, those buildings look like they were brought down with demolition. And when you stop, and the thing that troubles me is that if you begin to question what happened on 9/11, you're immediately attacked. You have the mainstream media attacks you. The government attacks you. Why? If what they told us is true, they should have no problem defending it.
Right, exactly.
But yet it seems they do have a problem defending it. And the big problems for me are questions. I question things, and when you question it, it seems in our state of our country today, we're not allowed to ask questions anymore, which is ridiculous. Thomas Jefferson said dissension's the greatest form of patriotism.
Exactly.
Question your government. Keep the feet to the fire. How, and I'll ask you guys this, how could those buildings fall at the rate of gravity?
They could
You're preaching to the choir with me, you know.
Breaking the laws of physics.
Yeah, it goes right against the basic concepts of physics. If, you know, if you dropped a billiard ball in a vacuum,
that building would have come down before the billiard ball.
It would have came down in 9.3 seconds.
Right. Yeah.
The billiard ball. These buildings are on the ground in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
That makes no sense. You got steel embraced in concrete, and supposedly they tell us it was a pancake effect. Well, it's still a moving object hitting one that's not moving, which would slow it down. How could it fall like free fall, like if you jumped out of the building and just fell to the ground?
Right.
With no resistance. Second, here's my next point. Jet fuel, which you in the Air Force should know, is four-fifths kerosene.
Exactly.
Well, kerosene doesn't burn very hot.
Right.
How could kerosene melt this? They told us it melted the structural steel, weakened it, and caused it to collapse. Well, using that analogy, then if you went out camping with a propane stove and you turned it on for a couple hours, propane burns hotter than kerosene.
Right.
It's a blue-white flame. If you put a can of beans on the grill, shouldn't the grill cave in?
Exactly.
Because of the heat that would weaken the metal? See, when you apply common sense to what happened that day, it doesn't add up. There's a smell. Something stinks.
Yeah, and it's not...
And my point being is, okay, then you look at the analogy of what... And the government's is merely a conspiracy theory. There's no proof. They've never even given us a flight manifest that shows these people were on the plane.
Right.
You can't get one.
Right.
Why not? Somebody checked them in.
Yep.
And the point being is that with all of these gaps in what they told us, I think we're entitled to the truth when we've changed our entire foreign policy based upon that event that day.
Oh, there's no question. You know,
and so I bring these questions up and I ask them, and it's amazing. All of a sudden you're called unpatriotic.
Right, right, right.
Well, why are you unpatriotic? Because my government has lied to me so many times they have no credibility. Case in point, us Vietnam guys. I was teaching at Harvard when McNamara came through. McNamara's now admitted the Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened. Exactly. Well, that was the catalyst that got us into the Vietnam War. They lied to us. Now, if they'd lie about that, wouldn't they lie again?
Oh, sure.
You don't want to get us into a war again? I feel the worst. I feel that this could well have been a setup to get us into invading Iraq.
Sure.
Yeah, and yeah. Why don't you segue into that since we're talking about Iraq?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on our getting involved with Iraq?
Well, first of all, I opposed Iraq before it even happened. Because, number one, Saddam didn't. If you believe 9/11 and what they told us, then Saddam had nothing to do with it. Why would we attack someone who didn't do anything to us? And right. That's what we did in Iraq. What troubled me was this. I'm of Slovak descent. And when I grew up, I believed the country was called Czechoslovakia because the big red machine Russia had put two countries and made one out of them, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And I was corrected by my 88-year-old aunt one time when they said, "What nationality are you?" I said, "I'm Czech." She spun around and said, "You're not Czech, you're Slovak." I learned that and felt I'd had my youth somewhat robbed of me because of that. Well, I never believed that our country would line up our military at the border of another sovereign nation without being asked, and that we would invade that nation, overthrow its government, and occupy it. That's what the communists did. That's what the Nazis did. Now we've done it. And the point, let me make a good reference here, too. Do you remember the movie Red Dawn?
Oh, of sure. Course. Loved it.
Great movie. Remember with Patrick Swayze and the
exactly.
Wolverines?
Oh, yeah.
And they're battling the people that invaded our country, right?
Terrific movie. Terrific right. movie.
Okay, if you looked at Patrick Swayze's character, Jed, and the Wolverines,
yeah.
Today they would be called insurgents.
Right, exactly.
Because we're the occupiers, people. We're those guys with the red stars that came into the movie, attacked and occupy, and are fighting Jed and the Wolverines. But now we call Jed an insurgent. Well, if I were an Iraqi and this outside entity invaded my country, I would be fighting us too.
Yep.
I would call him a freedom fighter, not an insurgent, because we're the menace. We're the ones that came in there. People forget that. See, we've developed an arrogance in this country. Like, I laugh when they talk about terrorism, that we're fighting terrorism.
Right.
We've been practicing terrorism on Cuba for 50 years.
And you were there, so you have a more of an insight than the majority of us, Jesse.
Well, I went there on a trade mission and met Castro, but look at history. We've burned their cane fields. We've blown planes out of the air where we've pardoned the guys that did it. We've attempted assassinations in Cuba. Is that not terrorism? And then the hypocrisy, too, that I want to point out, wasn't one of the big reasons we went into Vietnam was because of chemical weapons?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, what's napalm, guys?
Exactly.
That's a chemical weapon that we've been using since Vietnam and still use it today.
And it's how a come horrible it's
okay,
weapon.
How come it's okay for us to use a chemical
right.
weapon,
right.
but it's not okay for anyone else?
And it is absolutely a horrible, horrible weapon, and I have seen in my own eyes, Jesse, you may or may not have, in burn units that were in Vietnam at the time of kiddos and whatever that just happened to be collateral damage, if you will.
Sure.
You know, their skin basically falling off their bones because of this. It is an absolute horrendous weapon.
That's right, and it's chemical. And yet we use it and criticize someone else who does?
Yeah.
See, the hypocrisies that this country stands behind are just ridiculous as I see it. I mean, we've been practicing terrorism on Cuba for 50 years.
Yeah.
Attempting to assassinate Castro and all this stuff just because we disagree with him. Well, that's terrorism, in my opinion. So who are we, when we get hit, supposedly, to have all this criticism? You remember Che Guevara?
Oh, sure.
Well, Che developed a hatred for the United States, and I always remember I read a story where a writer criticized young people for wearing Che T-shirts because
right.
they said all Che was a murdering communist, which is true. But he didn't take it a step further. He should have asked, how does a doctor, a man of medicine, become a murdering communist? Well, Che became that way watching corporate America rape and pillage South America. In the Motorcycle Diaries, that's what it's all about.
Exactly.
Che didn't come out of birth hating America and hating democracy. Something had to compel him to be that way.
Exactly.
And see, that's what you need to look at. Our country, in my opinion, I love my country, but I think we should look into the mirror here, and we should take a hard look at what we truly stand for today.
Well, you know, you made a statement that I had shivers going up and down my spine. I'm just going to read this statement from you, Jesse. I believe patriotism comes from the heart. Patriotism is voluntary. It is a feeling of loyalty and allegiance that is a result of knowledge and belief. A patriot shows their patriotism through their actions, by their choice. No law will make a citizen a patriot. That just sends shivers up my spine, Jesse.
Well, it's the truth, I think. Because, I got in trouble here because, as governor, because of a number of things. I didn't think that the Pledge of Allegiance should be mandatory. To me, that's like the things that the brown shirts did to the kids in Germany when to start reciting stuff for the government. I was taught patriotism by my mom and dad. And I think that's the place it should be taught. Patriotism comes from the home. It doesn't come from being taught in school to be a patriot or being forced to, you know, say a pledge of allegiance before every class that you pledge allegiance to the flag.
Right.
Well, that should be voluntary. It shouldn't be mandatory. You don't do it because you're forced or told to do it.
Right. Yeah, it should be something of a love. It's like you say, it should come from the heart, not because you're just like a sheep being led and say, okay, this is what you need to do at this point, you know.
Yeah, well, and to me, if you look at the definition of fascism today, fascism by definition says when corporations team up with organized religion to control government.
Yeah.
Sounds familiar, don't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Sounds extremely familiar.
I think we're right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
You're going to find interesting, Jesse, that our members have just a ton of questions, and some of them I think are really going to strike chords with you based upon your book. John, go ahead and ask the first one.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was going to just say that for the past 3 weeks, we've posted up a very special thread for you, Jesse, for our members at AboveTopSecret.com to post questions for us to ask. And one of these members is by the name of Pistol Pete, and he says, Mr. Ventura, can you further expand on what transpired during your 1999 meeting with the CIA, and what do you believe was their ultimate purpose for having the meeting with you?
That meeting took place early in my career as governor. I was asked to go to the basement and meet with 23 members of the CIA. Well, all of us that have been in the military know what being asked really is. We would like to talk to you. Well, no, I don't want to. Well,
we'll still meet you down in the basement.
I took it as this. I didn't realize my full power yet, so I took it as an obligation that I should talk to these people.
Right.
Now, when I got down into the room, I was placed in a chair, and they were in a big half moon around me. They were very proper. They were very cordial. They were very respectful. But I said to them at the get-go, I said, well, before I answer any of your questions, I have a few that I want answered. They said, well, what are they? And I said, well, my first question is, what are you doing here? Your charter says you're not to be operational within the United States of America, and I believe this is. Why are you here?
Uh-huh.
Well, I couldn't get a straight answer on that. I then said, okay, go around the room. I want you to tell me your name and what you do. I couldn't get a straight answer from them on that.
Wow.
So I basically said, well, being that you're not cooperating a great deal with me, I'm going to find it difficult to cooperate with you. But in essence, through their questioning, when I got home that day, I called my friend Dick Marcinko, who writes the Rogue Warrior books.
Right. Yes, yes.
Formed SEAL Team 6. Dick's a 30-year SEAL. He dealt a lot with the CIA, so I figured if anyone would know, it'd be Dick. And I called Dick, and I told him what happened, and he started laughing. And he said he didn't know for sure, but he had a pretty good idea of what they wanted to know. And I said, well, you're 3 steps ahead of me. What do you know? and I think he was correct when he said this. They didn't see me coming, because all their questions dealt with how I won the election.
Really?
Yeah. and see, the CIA's job is to gather intelligence and then make predictions to our government of what's going down.
Right.
And I think they needed, like Marcinko said, they didn't see you coming, and they want to know, is there 10 more independent governors on the horizon that we've missed? Because yeah. all their questions dealt with how I got elected.
In 1999, your approval rate was the highest of any governor in Minnesota history at 73%. So, I mean, you were independent. I mean, what do you attribute all that to?
I attribute it to exactly what my book's about, the disgust we have with the two-party system, how they're not making decisions for the public. They're making it for the power of their parties. They're making party decisions as opposed to decisions for the republic. And I think people, if you poll people in Minnesota today, independent voters outnumber Democrats and Republicans, people right. who claim to be independent. Well, if you offer them a legitimate centrist independent candidate, as I was, it proves you can win. Because the two parties are controlled by their extremes, the extreme left for the Democrat, the extreme right for the Republican. In order to get their party endorsement, they have to sell out to the left, sell out to the right. Mm-hmm. And the moment they get it, then they beeline back to the center because they know it's the middle of the road that's going to either elect them or not.
Right.
And see, and we're not represented. All of us people that are, as I call, a centrist. I'm fiscally conservative, but I'm socially liberal. I don't care if gays get married. It's none of the government's business, in my opinion.
Sure.
I don't think the government should be involved in a woman's right to choose. You know, that's between her, her clergy, and her beliefs,
and
not the government.
I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you.
Well, who stands up for us that believe like me? You're fiscally conservative, you want less government, but yet you're socially liberal. Nobody. So, you know, that I think is the reason my approval ratings reach so high. Now, granted, they didn't stay there, because you're forced to make a lot of difficult decisions, and some of those decisions are going to piss certain people off.
Of course. Sure.
So, you know, I view a high rating the same way I do a low one. You know, take something in between and figure that's where you're at.
We have another member by the name of Spartan King Leonidas who asked this question. My question for you, Mr. Ventura, is this. Being a former Navy SEAL, what do you think of organizations like Blackwater, DINCOR, and Triple Canopy being in Iraq? And you were doing yet a different code of ethics than they are. What are your thoughts on them?
Well, first of all, Blackwater is owned by a former Navy SEAL and has a lot of Navy SEALs in it, but they're mercenaries, nothing more than that. They are professional soldiers who are paid way more money than our soldiers are, and they don't have to follow any rules. Well, in my opinion, we don't. Why are there equal number of independent private contractors in Iraq as there are our military? You know, to me, that's fishy from the word go.
Right.
And I don't agree that we should be supporting mercenary soldiers. I mean, we should be supporting our soldiers, and mercenaries should have no part in it, in my opinion.
Well, okay. Jesse, you know, we don't want to infringe on your time, but if unless you're objectionable, if we could have a few more minutes so we could ask a few more questions from the
members. Yeah, I'll take a couple more.
Okay, good. All right, here's one, and this is when I read this thing, it kind of really hit the point home for me. This is from member four of the fight. It says, Jesse, I think it is great that you have the courage to speak out about how you feel about things. I was wondering, since you have started speaking out about the government, has your life been threatened in any way?
No, my life has not been threatened, but I do fear that my phones get tapped.
Huh.
I think that happened, and I write about it in my book. I think they were doing it even when I was governor. Because
really?
Remember, I don't come from the status quo. I don't come from the two parties. I'm a rogue and a renegade. And I think that, like right now, the red herrings I see. Arlen Specter, the senator from Pennsylvania, is investigating whether the New England Patriots taped other teams in football, right?
Yeah.
Why isn't he investigating illegal wiretapping by our government?
Yeah.
You know, it would seem to me that would be something he ought to be doing, not worrying about what the NFL is doing.
Yeah.
Second of all,
Right.
The government investigating steroids in baseball. First of all, unless you're gambling on the game, it's irrelevant whether steroid players play or not, whether they win or lose. You're not losing anything unless you're a gambler.
Right.
Second of all, why aren't they investigating, instead of steroids in baseball, why aren't they investigating the billions of dollars that's unaccountable that we've lost in the Iraq war?
Sure.
Wouldn't that be what they ought to be doing?
Absolutely.
Instead of these red herrings?
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
What the government does is they confuse the public and they go after these trivial issues that are really meaningless so that we won't bear down on the ones that are meaningful.
That segues perfectly into this next question from this member, because we've all wondered this ourselves, and it's by Mr. Gunter. Member Mr. Gunter wants to know, Jesse, if you were to run in 08, and we all acknowledge that we think you should, who might your running mates be, and what size longboard do you surf with?
First of all, my buddy Rudd, a 70-year-old surfer, gave me the longboard. I haven't actually measured it. But it is long. Us big guys need them long, because when you're just learning, you need as much underneath your feet as you can get.
Right.
Now, having talked about surfing, what was the first half of the question again?
He wants to know, if you were to run in 08, who might your running mates be?
Oh, I'll tell you, my perfect running mate that I would choose would be Governor Angus King from Maine. Now, a lot of people don't know of Governor King, but he was an independent governor while I got all the publicity. He actually served 4 years before me and then served the 4 years with me.
Wow.
And so I would call Governor King on occasion for advice, because he had been there and done that. He did his 8 years in Maine, and the press came up to him at the end and they said, Governor King, what's it going to be now? Is it going to be Congress? Is it going to be the Senate? He looked at them and said, no, I'm going home.
Hmm.
Golly.
Imagine that concept. No, I'm going home. He said, there's many things in my private life that have been unattended for my 8 years as governor. I feel I have to go back and take care of things in my private life. And off he went. But Governor Angus King of Maine would be he would be, if not my choice for president, he would certainly be my choice to run with.
Sure.
Brilliant man.
Wow. Well, you know, you've been very courteous with your time, but as we end this thing, I want to mention that when you chose a person to be sworn in as governor, you chose one of your SEAL instructors, Master Chief Petty Officer Terry Mother Moy. And the thing I love about this, there's a couple of things I love about when you were governor. One is the bumper sticker, my governor can beat up your governor. I love that. You know, I don't think there was any governor that could have whipped your buttocks, Jesse.
I don't think even Arnold could.
I don't think Arnold could either, yeah.
You know, he came after me, but remember, Arnold's just a bodybuilder.
That's right.
Yeah, he's not a wrestler, trust me. We all know that.
He doesn't know how to put the sugar hold on, which will knock you out in 2 seconds flat.
Tell me about Master Chief Petty Officer Terry Mother Moy, why you chose him for the inauguration.
Well, Mother Moy was my first phase instructor in UDT SEAL training. He was the most terrifying man I'd ever met in my life. I was 18 years old. He was probably 29. He has the name Mother because there's another word that follows it.
Oh, yeah, we know that word.
You know, and but he is a man today. We've become very close friends. He's a man with a golden heart, a heart of gold. There's nothing he won't do for you, and he is one of my most admired people because he is the man that prepared me to be a frogman or a Navy SEAL. He made me live up to the standards that are required to do that job. So in essence, he made me the man that I am today. Let me give you a Moy story, though, In first phase, when I got there to training, I got there on Friday, class started Monday, so I had no pre-training. On Tuesday, you run the O course. Well,
that's
the obstacle course, when you get good at it, the obstacle course.
Right.
When you get good at that, you usually run it in about 10 minutes. The first time I ran it, it took me 43.
Golly.
Oh, boy. You're kidding.
Because the instructors are harassing you and all that, and you don't know what you're doing. And
right.
It's on purpose.
Right.
Well, when they finished at the end of the day, my hands weren't tough enough yet. And so I had like three or four of these big flapping blisters on each hand.
Right.
You know, where they're ripped open and they're bleeding and pus coming out of them and all that.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, Mother Moy came out at the end of the day and set a table down in a first aid kit. And he turned to us trainees. He says, okay, which one of you pukes as flappers? And me, like a dummy, I thought I needed some medical attention. I raised my hand. I said, well, I do, Instructor Moy. He said, come on up here, boy. So I ran up there. He looked. He says, oh, you got some good ones. He said, are you right-handed or left-handed? I said, I'm right-handed. He said, then hold out your right hand. I held it out. He tore each one of them off.
Oh!
Now, why did he ask me if I was right-handed or left-handed? Because when he was done, he then had me turn to the class. He said, now, in front of the class, you do your other hand.
Oh, my Lord.
My goodness.
So I had to pull the flappers off my left hand because I'm right-handed. Then when I was done, Moy told me, now get back in line, you big dummy. Now, what did I learn from that? I learned from that, don't bring any attention to yourself.
Yeah.
Get through this training as easily as possible, and don't let the instructors ever know what your name is or anything about you if you can help it, because they're not going to bring you pleasure. They're going to bring you pain.
It's under the radar, I think they call it, Jesse.
Whatever. But that's a great Terry Mother Moy story about when he made me rip my flappers off and then had me turn to the class, goodness. And by then I had tears running down my face. I was crying like a baby.
Oh man.
Because let me tell you, it hurt.
Well, let me tell you that...
You taught me a good lesson.
I bet. A number of our members here at AboveTopSecret.com want to thank you for participating in this very special interview. But they all agree on this one thing, and it's kind of a universal question, which is this. Jesse, could you please do us all a favor and go to Washington and put Dick Cheney in a full Nelson and bring him a world of hurt?
Well, actually, what I'd like to do with Dick Cheney, being that Dick had 5 deferments from the military, do you all remember when he shot the guy hunting in Texas?
Yeah, accidentally, supposedly.
Well, they called that an accident. I got news for you. Unless you're in combat with a weapon, there are no accidents. It's called negligence. There is no accident with a weapon. And what I'd like to do is have our former defense secretary, Dick Cheney, I'd prefer him to do boot camp, which is something he missed out on,
right,
where they will teach him how to use that weapon so that he will never shoot anyone again because he'll know what he's doing. You know what really appalled me about that situation, and it speaks volumes for the United States today?
What's that?
The guy who got shot apologized.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense.
When I heard that, I almost fell over in the chair. I said, you got to be kidding me. The guy that got shot apologized? Excuse me, the guy doing the shooting ought to be the one apologizing.
Right.
Because, as I said, there is no negligence with a weapon. I mean, there is no accident with a weapon unless you're in combat. Other than that, it's negligence. On that note, guys, I got to run.
All right, well, listen, if you give us one last thing, and that is the famous Navy SEAL cry, we would appreciate it, Jesse.
For me, it was hoo-yah, Class 58.
Hoo-yah, you're back to you,
that's
Jesse.
Right.
Okay.
Can't thank
Have
you enough for your
one,
time,
guys.
Brother.
Thank
all
you,
right,
Jesse.
Bye. Bye.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
Now, we've let the ATS Mix microphone out loose on the streets to find out what America thinks.
Am I on the air?
Are you listening?
Hold on to your speakers, because this is I'm Mad as Hell and Don't Want to Take It Anymore. Starring the people that are out there on the streets. And also with Dave Rabbit.
Well, it's mad as hell, and you were out in the field one more time, Senor Rabbit. Where did your ventures take you this time?
Well, you know, I went out to East Texas. You know, I filled up my van with $95 worth of gas and headed out to do some things. But this particular Mad as Hell has to do with a young woman, not a young woman, maybe, but a woman I met, 62. Her name is Jean, and she is from a little town in East Texas that has a population of about 1,100 called Caddo Mills, Texas. And
I spent a week there one night.
Did you really? You're so full of it. at the Caddo Hotel. Or the Cattle Hotel.
Yeah,
not sure.
All right.
But and I've just been dying to talk to someone that, you know, lived up in the country, kind of like the Green Acres thing.
Right.
Farm living is a life for me and all that stuff. And see how everything is affecting those people in the country. I mean, the farming community, you know. And so that was the reason that I went there. And I think she's got some, you know, I tell you, I was very impressed with not only her intelligence level, but just how sharp she was about, you know, the questions that I asked her. And she was very, very open and very point blank with it.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. So let's listen in now.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
John, I'm out here in East Texas, and I have been dying to stop and talk to somebody that's from the country and how things affect them and don't affect them. And I've met this wonderful lady by the name of Jean, and she has was born and bred country girl, sand between her toes, right? You know what they say about sand between her toes? Oh, yeah. Johnny and I have talked about that before. Okay, Jean, let's kind of bring up to where we are today. On my way to East Texas, I went by several truck stops and had a chance to talk to some truckers and whatever. And gas prices here in East Texas were like $3.79 for just regular gas. So as a 62-year-old woman that is kind of independent, how is the gas prices affecting your personal lifestyle?
Well, I'll be getting a half a tank instead of a full tank because I made the mistake of filling my car up the other day and not paying attention, and it was $56, and I have a very small car and a very small tank. So that took about probably $25 out of my food budget that I wasn't prepared for it to do.
Right.
So next time I'll get a half a tank instead of a full tank.
Okay. You know, I find it interesting, and before we started this interview, I talked to you about a couple of things, and you said some things that made me want to interview you very badly, and that is you touched briefly on some observations that you had made about food shortages and things. Would you mind telling me, our listeners, you know, what you experienced when you went to Sam's?
Well, there was a big sign up saying that they were limiting rice to one. I think there are probably the 30 or 50 pound bags. And there's always been no limit. You could buy whatever you could afford to buy.
Right.
Now there was a sign up saying that it was limited to one of these bags per person.
So,
never seen any rationing or limiting of how much you could buy unless it was some great sale. But this wasn't. This was just normal, everyday pricing.
Okay, so what do you believe is causing them to do this?
I think people are afraid. I think they're getting scared that they're not going to have enough money to do what they need to do and then have food money left over. I mean, somewhere, something is going to be misplaced. Is it going to be my gas to go to work in? Is it going to be my food that I put on the table? Is it going to be whether I can afford to have heat or air conditioning in my house? Can I water my lawn? Is all my lawn going to die because I have to have that money to put in the gas tank now to get me to work?
Right.
It's got to stop somewhere. I mean, it's got to make, you can't make it work on imaginary money. There's only so much in our budget, and something's got to be sacrificed for it.
Now, you have your own home, obviously.
Yes.
Have you had to make any decisions on how you run your own household because of the way the economy is?
Well, I know it hasn't been doing this long, but from the spring, I've not fertilized my yard, and I usually do. Because I cannot afford to water my yard like I usually do. And if you fertilize it and can't water it, it's going to die.
Right.
I have not added or replaced any of the dead plants that died in my yard because I can't afford to, because the money that I could have done that with has now gone to feed my car.
Right. All right, what about utilities and stuff? I mean, you have a very nice home. So do you have a scenario to where you've maybe cut back or cut the air conditioner up higher or whatever?
The air conditioner hadn't even been turned on.
So you don't cut your air conditioner on at all anymore?
I haven't for the last year. Things have been getting a little harder, but this year is ridiculous. I don't know whether I'll ever be able to turn it on this year or not. If I'm having to put an extra $50 a week in my car, that's 4 weeks. Doesn't take a mathematician to realize that's $200.
Right.
That's almost my electric bill. Now, what do I do? Put gas in my car to go to work or turn my electricity, my air conditioner on and pay my electric bill? I've got a choice. I'm on a fixed income. People say fixed income, they think older people on Social Security. We're all on a fixed income. We go to work, we work, gets X amount of dollars.
Right.
We have X amount of expenses. When the expenses go up and the income doesn't, something's got to give.
Right. And what does? And, of course, you have to make that
intelligent
decision.
Every
right.
person, individual family, is going to have to make that decision. Do the kids quit taking piano lessons? Do they quit playing soccer because right. you can't afford the extra $60 for the registration fee? It's going to impact every aspect of our family unit at whatever age level they are.
Okay, now, you know, I interviewed somebody a few weeks ago, and they made a statement that really blew me away. And we were here again talking about the rising gas costs. Now, at the time, gas in Texas was averaging around $3.45. Now we're at almost $3.80, or 40 cents per gallon more. At the time, 3 weeks ago, this lady told me, now she's from Dallas, but their church, they were going to this one on the hill or over in Rockwall, I believe, East Texas. And because of the gas prices, that it was preventing them from going to church because the money it would cost them to put the gas in their car to go to church, they needed to both get to their jobs. They were a two-income family, to get to their jobs on the following week. So, in essence, the gas prices were preventing them from worshiping, you know, however they want to worship. Now, have you been around a religious community? Have you seen maybe how it's impacting folks in their church activities and stuff?
Not a great deal, but what it's going to do, I believe this, is with everything, church, entertainment, visiting family that lives off far away, we're going to pull back and become more isolated in our own communities because we're not going to have the money to put in our gas tanks to travel an hour and a half to go visit relatives as often as we wanted to.
Right.
We'll choose places to shop closer to us. People that have businesses that are further away from housing communities
right.
where most of the people are,
right.
are going to begin to suffer. People are going to start buying closer to home because it takes more gas. You say, well, over here has better prices. Well, not when you compensate it with the amount of gas it will take to go that far.
Right.
It won't. So the businesses that are further away from the mass of the people will begin to suffer. It's going to have to.
Right. All right, now you made another comment before we started this interview that kind of blew me away, and it's really one of my favorite restaurants, is Chick-fil-A. Tell our listeners what you told me when you went to the Chick-fil-A recently here in East Texas.
I saw that they had restructured their whole menu. I don't know whether all of them have done it, but at the one I went to, it had. It had what I normally get was the six-piece strip meal with the fries and the drink. It's usually around $5, $4.89 or something. When I went, the option for six was no longer there. You could get three or four chicken strips. The price has now gone up to $6.45. Will that affect me going to Chick-fil-A? You say, well, it's only a dollar, dollar and a half. Well, you know.
That's a dollar, dollar half a day, even if you chose that as your...
It's just a sign of the times. I shop at Walmart for groceries and things. Already on a few items that I buy consistently every week, I'm noticing maybe not a great huge amount already, but a few pennies higher here and there. You know, it's going up. Why do people think that they can put pressure on one end of something and not feel it's a ripple effect? It's going to have an effect across every aspect of our lives.
Right. Well, because you grew up in the country and you've been around, you know, the farming community, and I believe you tell me that your grandparents were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, considering that Americans really have a huge reliance on the farming community, I mean, for fresh vegetables and crops and stuff, how do you think it's going to affect the American farmer with what's going on? I mean, because obviously they need diesel to run their tractors, and diesel's right now today $4.65 was the cheapest I saw. Diesel to run their tractors, and then of course they've got their own, you know, personal expenses that they have to have. But what's even scarier than that is, to my knowledge, from the things that I've learned and researched about farmers, you know, on their crops, I mean, they have to go out and take out loans from banks that, you know, are charging them, obviously, interest on that money. And by the time they sell their crops, if they eke out, you know, a $12,000 profit for the year, which is divided out in a year, maybe $1,000 a month, I mean, how do farmers going to stay in business this way, Jane, do you think?
No.
I mean, you think we're going to see a time to where it's going to have to be, there's no longer going to be, I guess, individual farmers, and it's going to get to this conglomerate kind of thing because they're the only ones that's going to be able to have the money to do farming anymore.
I don't know. I think it's a scary prospect one way or the other. When they're taking the ability to provide for our families, make a living out of the hands of the people, and putting it into the hands of government and large corporations.
Right.
I think it's a sign of the times that we're losing our individuality. We're losing our very freedom that our country is founded on.
Right.
Of we have an inalienable right to seek prosperity as long as we're within the confines of the law. You know, we have a right to try to make a living for ourselves. But yet the very essence of our economy is driving us to the point we're not going to be able to do that.
Right.
Just like you said, farmers, they're not going to continue to be able to do that if they're making $1,000 profit and they're using up half or more of it now in not only their diesel fuel, but the cost of the seed, the cost of the fertilizer, the soil conditioner, water if they're irrigating. All of those things are going to get more expensive because they're indirectly linked back to people that have to deliver those goods by using gas or diesel to get them there. It's going to make a tremendous impact on everybody.
Right. Do you think we're ever going to get to a time to where people are going to get so fed up that they're going to hit the streets and try to get the government to do anything about all this?
I don't know. We like to think that people have good sense, and we like to think that people know better. But desperation causes people to do stupid things. All I can say is I don't think any of us know what we'll do until we're desperate enough or mad enough. I just remember back in 1700 and something, there was a bunch of folks that got real irritated and real fed up with government control that was taxing them unfairly, giving them an unfair share of the profit, and it caused a revolution.
Right.
It does it in other countries around the world all the time. I pray that America finds some solution to this before it comes to that right here on our own soil.
Thanks, Jane. Well, John, that's it from East Texas. I don't think you can get it any more plainer and simpler than that.
You know what, Dave? She sounded like, and I don't care how small of a population this area was, as you mentioned in our intro of this, it sounded like she was very, very smart and intelligent and very concerned also.
You know, she didn't look 62, I'll give you that. But, you know, and I kind of was kidding because I wanted to throw that in for you because I'm always talking about, you know, East Texas girls with the sand between their toes. But, you know, she was pretty hot for 62. But what?
Just this is the strangest closer to a mad as hell.
I just call them like I see them, you know. You can't tell everything by the voice, you know. But anyway, she really did. She was really great, and the hospitality was great, and the iced tea was great, and you know, she had me slop some hogs afterwards. But other than that, you know, it was a pretty good interview. So yeah, it was pretty fun.
ATS Mix.
Yeah, listen up.
From above, top secret.
Jesus Christ.
.com.
Well, Dave, as you remember, not too long ago, we had Stan Deo on, and he was giving some of his thoughts about some of the earthquakes that were happening, not just around the world, but kind of primarily about in the Nevada area, where they've had just numerous earthquakes going on.
Right, yeah.
Well, we had a number of members that sent us U2U saying, hey, have you heard of Charlotte King? Of course, I had heard of her on Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell and George Norrie, and I thought, you know, it would be great if we could get her on. So what we're going to do is we're going to have her come on in episode 83. That's going to be our following week's program, but we also thought it would be kind of nice to have her on right now to maybe address some of the concerns that some of the members and friends around the world have about what's happening right now. So right now, let's bring on Charlotte King. Hi, Charlotte. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, Charlotte. We really appreciate you at the last minute coming in here. John, go ahead. You seem to have more geographic knowledge of what's happening that Charlotte needs to address real quick.
Well, sure. What we had a number of members and listeners alike express their concerns in primarily the Reno area and also Bakersfield. Supposedly, Bakersfield is getting overrun by frogs, and they want to know if this might be a precursor to some earthquakes or something. And you are the person in the know, so where should we be watching out for this next week before our interview comes up?
Well, first of all, I want to have you understand that I usually get 12 to 72 hour lead time.
Okay.
Generally, except for Washington State, I get 84 hours, but every place else is 72 hours, give or take 12 hours.
Right.
So it's really difficult to make a very long-term prediction based on symptoms, so I can tell people what to look for and what they might be feeling and what it may mean.
And, are you feeling anything right now?
Well, I've been having some right rib pain again this afternoon, and that is what I have termed the Domino Islands, and that would be Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, the Loyalty Islands, the Admiralty Islands, the Solomons, those areas. That is always the right rib pain.
Right.
And it feels like, you know, like somebody hit you in the ribs. I've had some left earache, and again, that is China. It can also extend to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India, Nicobar Islands, but mostly China, especially if you get a kind of a sound with it. That's that sounds like cellophane crackling.
Right.
That's what it sounds like.
You know, China just had that huge earthquake. Were you able to sense that before it happened?
The big one, yes, I was, actually. Lots of earaches, left side. Lots of earaches. And I had a sense that there was going to be a large number of people die, and I put that out on my website.
Right. Speaking of such...
Or on my email.
Yeah, speaking of the website, Charlotte, tell everybody what your website is, please.
Okay, my website is www.visor, that's V like Victor, I, S like Sam, .net, /, and then the little tilde sign, which is next to the one, and Sharking, and then /.
And by Sharking, you mean like Charking.
Charking.
Yeah. K-I-N-G, that's
and
right.
And we'll post a shortcut for all the members so they can go to your website also. But don't you also have something really neat to where they can sign up to have email notices or something?
Yes, they can. They can email me directly at Sharking, that's Charking, at Visor, V like Victor, I, S like Sam, .net. And just tell me you would like to sign up for the free emails, and I will put you on the list.
Fantastic. Well, we can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to do this little teaser trailer for our upcoming interview that we'll be having next week, and we certainly do appreciate
it. That's
okay.
All right, we look forward to talking to you next week, Charlotte. Thanks a lot for just dropping in and giving us this kind of a heads up for this week.
Okay. I'll see you next week.
Okay, great.
Thanks. And just one more time, we want to really thank Charlotte from the bottom of our heart for taking time out of her busy schedule before doing our interview, our official interview with her next week, for her coming on here to kind of do this little teaser trailer. Although, you know what, Dave? I still didn't find out why those damn frogs are invading Bakersfield.
Oh, I know why. You know, I mean, it's one of those prince and frog things, you know.
What?
You know, well, you know, they're heading in there trying to see if somebody will kiss them and turn them into the prince, you know. That's all there
We're
is to
We're literally
it.
Talking about thousands of frogs.
So? You think there's not...
So you're saying there's thousands of princes jumping around in Bakersfield?
Well, Britney Spears thinks they are.
They
I don't know.
They could have picked a better place than Bakersfield. Let me tell you this about that.
But see, that's a perfect place. Then you can have frog legs. Bakersfield. Baker's Frogs. don't know. I have no clue. I don't
ditto.
Know.
Ditto.
What, ditto that you have no clue?
That's correct. I have no idea where you were going.
Hey, by the way, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You want to know why?
No, I give up.
I found out today that they're killing the Frasier comedy Back to You with Patricia Heaton.
And why is that?
Because they had to make a choice between that and that lumberjack guy that was the brother of Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, the big tall guy.
Brad Garrett.
Yeah, Brad Garrett, thank you. You know, and I mean, they had to make a decision, and they was costing them a lot more money to have Frasier or Kelsey Grammer and Patricia Heaton than it was him, and so they killed their show. Now, that tells you what the mainstream media is really having problems with. I mean, when they sit there and they're trying to, they kill Kelsey Grammer and Patricia Heaton in a knockout show to save money, that tells you something right there, doesn't it, baby puppy?
I don't know. I have to be honest with you. I've never watched either one of those shows.
Well, hell, that's the reason why they were canceled, John. Damn. T-boy, will you?
We want to thank everybody for listening to this episode. We hope everybody enjoyed Jesse Ventura. Hey, wasn't he a great interview guest?
Well, yeah, and you know Jesse and I are having lunch. I think it's a week from Thursday, John. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to play butt darts.
And send those U2Us to Dave Rabbit. Hey, thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll catch you next week on the ATS Mix.
With a minigun.
Sorry.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.